Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Iris Murdoch podcast. As it's our 50th episode, we're going to be answering questions from our regular listeners this time around. So if you want to know what these are in advance, you can see them in the detail below the podcast, or you can keep listening and of course you'll find out. Joining me to answer your questions is Dr. Daniel Reed from the University of Kingston. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Dan, of course, is no stranger to the podcast, and he's been spending time in the archives working on his forthcoming book, Iris Murdoch and the Problem of Evil, which will be out later this year with Palgrave in the Iris Murdoch Today series, and as well as spending some time getting answers to your questions. So, Dan, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
I love it to be here. Yeah.
We've certainly got a good range of questions in front of us. So where shall we go? Well, let's start with the big one, shall we?
Yeah.
Our first question, Kevin asks, is it possible to say where Murdoch stands in relation to other great writers? Is she on a par with Dickens, Shakespeare, or others, for example? Wow. What do we think?
Quite a big question.
Certainly is.
As much as, I kind of feel like I'm not as big of a Dickens reader as I should be to feel kind of comfortable to answer the question. But I think it's I think Murdoch would certainly appreciate the comparison. You know, she certainly rated writers like Dickens and Shakespeare. She said that both of them, she wanted both of them to have an influence on her writing. In an interview in the 1970s, she says that she'd particularly like to be influenced by writers like Homer and Shakespeare. She seems kind of less direct about saying she wants to be influenced by someone like Dickens, but I think her enjoyment and kind of appreciation of his writing comes through in the sense that she wants to kind of write a novel that kind of responds to something a bit like the 19th century novel.
Yeah, I was thinking of the major novels that are set in London. We think of A Word Child, don't we? Bits of Nice and the Good, Under the Net, Black Prince. You can feel occasionally that Dickensian influence hanging over the description of buildings, streets, pubs, for example, can't you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, now you mention it. Yeah, and yeah, definitely the kind of if yeah, yes, that kind of engagement with London, certainly. And I mean, I kind of think as well of some of those kind of late novels like, The Philosopher's Pupil or The Book and the Brotherhood, where they feel like they've got a really large social scene that's
Oh,
quite
yeah.
kind of
Family
complicated.
saga, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those certainly feel more Dickensian. Where on the other hand, you've got ones that feel slightly more Shakespearean in the sense that they've got that more kind of closed cast feel, you know, or kind of limited, with kind of limited kind of locations that the characters are engaged in, you know, things like A Severed Head, or maybe I'm thinking of another one, but it won't come to me.
Well, it's certainly the influence of Midsummer Night's Dream on something like Fairly Honourable Defeat, isn't
Yes,
it?
that's one I was thinking of.
And later on, of course, the influence of The Tempest on The Sea, Philosopher's Pupil again. You know, I mean, direct references. There's direct references to Shakespeare in so many of the so many of her novels, aren't there? It's difficult to kind of pick it out in a short podcast, a short response to
Yeah,
them.
absolutely. I mean, and also I suppose kind of the other way of that she did as well, it's worth remembering, write plays for a short time. She went through a period of reading
Of course.
Shakespeare in the 1960s in quite a lot of detail. And that definitely, I think, marks some of that fiction. But I'm not sure she would feel comfortable saying that she was, approaching his skill.
No,
And I don't
absolutely
say that
not.
in a way to kind of belittle her work, but just to say that I think she saw him as such a kind of huge figure in literature that, she might not have
Yeah, well, she calls
felt
him the
that.
patron saint of the novelist, doesn't she? And I think it
Yes,
was at
she does.
66, 67 through to about 69. She reads all the plays, all the sonnets, and kind of reflects on them. The thing I always consider is, if you're thinking about like the Shakespearean Murdoch or the Dickensian Murdoch or the Austinian Murdoch, how difficult it is to see that kind of direct, is it a direct influence, which I think we can say with Shakespeare, or is it kind of filtered through others? So there are so many other novelists that she's reading in, but that have kind of that were operating in between that particular time frame.
Definitely.
That you know, is she picking it up from later novelists who have been subsequently influenced by Shakespeare or by Dickens? Certainly she says that she feels closer to Dickens and of course Dostoevsky and the great Russians than she does to Joyce and Wolfe. I mean, to
Yeah.
that kind of modernist influence.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, she was certainly not as kind of sure about I think, well, I think she liked some of the things that the experiments that the modernists brought did for literature, in the sense that maybe it kind of helped to reinvigorate some of the energy around kind of novels and things like that, to novel writing. But yeah, she certainly wanted a kind of she wanted something that looked more like a Dickens novel than like a James Joyce novel or a Virginia Woolf novel.
Yeah, and I think we see that a little bit with some of the writers and poets of of her generation as well. Sort of get that kind of rejection of some kind of very of say Ezra Pound's poetry by someone like Philip Larkin, who says that we'd need literature that responds to the everyday, to the rather than poetry that responds and requires knowledge of other poems or needs a load of footnotes. I think
Yeah,
Murdoch, so
absolutely.
Murdoch wants to get her hands dirty, as it were, in the real stuff of human life, rather than spending too much time worrying about streams of consciousness, for example.
Yeah, I think that she felt that. I mean, obviously, she does use kind of things that we might think of as being stream, that we might, she does use stream of consciousness in her novels, but I think she would say things like, you know, maybe the kind of the way that stream of consciousness enters her novel might look more like, I don't know, Jane Austen than it does like Virginia Woolf. You know, it's not
Yeah, sure.
you know, a mark on the wall that kind of takes up the character's focus. It ends up being something else, something
Oh,
real.
the short story mark on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd certainly agree with that. And of course when she was reading Wolfe as an example, wasn't she? On Wolfe's centenary for and she gave a she spoke at the Wolfe Centenary Conference. And both she and John Bailey said that it was the Voyage Out and Night and Day, those two realist novels at the beginning of Wolfe's career, that were the best, and that when she goes beyond that, particularly when she moves through to The Waves and Between the Acts, that she they just kind of they couldn't follow her, they just didn't enjoy them. I don't think that went down particularly well at a Wolfe conference, where those are kind of held up as, you know, superlative works and of high modernism. But there you are, that wasn't what
Yeah, I suppose
Murdoch's doing.
that is part of the problem.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the other way we can think about this question as well, so where does Murdoch stand in relationship to other great writers, is also things like how she was also received and kind of how people responded to her at the time. I mean,
Yep.
reviewers and fellow writers would definitely praised her craft. You know, we know that there are writers that acknowledged her influence. So people like Zadie Smith, Sarah Perry, Sarah Waters, and Ian McEwan all show kind of some influence. All kind of show the influence of Murdoch, or have said that she was an influence on her work. I think we might say similar things about A.S. Byatt, that
Oh,
A.S. Byatt was
definitely.
also friends with Murdoch. And so there's a kind of further connection there. She also receives a number of awards for books. So The Black Prince won the James Tait Black Memorial Prize. The Sacred and Profane Love Machine won the Whitbread Literary Award for Fiction. I think that might now be related to Costa. I'm not sure. Costa
I think
Book
it is
Award or
now,
something like
yeah.
that. And she was also awarded the Booker Prize in
Of course.
1978 for The Sea, the Sea. And she's now the prize is named after her in her honour, so that's
The
also
trophy
nice.
is, yeah.
And then, of course, she was also made a Dame to Literature about 10 years after that in 1987.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, she was certainly well respected in her time, and she also made quite a lot of money from her novels. I mean, so if we look at Peter Conradi's biography, he mentions how he kind of talks about some of the kind of advances she was given, or kind of the amounts that she made from her play, for example, A Severed Head. I mean, the novels, so he says that in the 1980s she was getting an advance of around £50,000 per novel. That equates to about £140,000 today. So I mean, that's
That's not
a
bad.
fair way.
I think
Yeah.
I don't think there are many novelists today that would get that, do you?
No, I mean, obviously that may say something about the changing kind of the way that kind of publishing has changed as an industry,
Yeah,
but
yeah,
she
yeah.
certainly, yeah. And at her death, her estate was valued at kind of 1.8 million. So That was in kind of 2000, thereabouts. That obviously included things like kind of property and stuff like that. But that, I mean, that is a pretty good estate to be leaving behind.
It is, yeah, and the obviously there is still a legacy estate which still makes money, of course, not as much as that by any means, but books still do sell. And I think it's that question now, really, that you and I and so many other people, you know, my wonderful guest on the podcast, in a sense, really, the kind of the a bigger question really is, where does Murdoch fit into the canon of the post Second World War scene, really, in literature? And I think she is now pretty secure, really, as a kind of as a major figure, as opposed to some other, you know, writers of the same time who are beginning now to not exactly disappear, but certainly are not very particularly widely read.
And I mean, we still do see, you know, we know that Vintage republished a number of her novels with new covers fairly recently. So, you know, that would suggest that there is some kind of de there is a desire to have her work still in print. And I think, I mean, I agree. I do think she has a place in that kind of post-war novel. Post-war literature space. I know that as someone who lectures at university, we do include her as a kind of post-war writer. So for things like her engagement with things like London post-war and Under the Net and things like that. So yeah.
Yeah, I think she fits in there, doesn't she? I mean, she fits into the she, you can fit her into the novel of ideas, whether that's a good thing or not. How would you say, a writer of London, a writer of family drama, a writer about the environment, a writer who reflects deeply on something that I know you're writing on, the problem of evil, morality, ethics, moral psychology. You could do all sorts of. I think the great thing with Murdoch is you can do so much with her fiction.
Definitely. So I mean, I think in that sense, it feels like I think she's whether or not we could say she was on par with Dickens and Shakespeare is a different question, or perhaps a difficult question to
It was a
answer.
different time as well. I mean, different time. My goodness, how do you know, think about the mid 19th century publishing scene, or you think about, you know, think about Renaissance drama? It's difficult, isn't it? But I think as somebody who is deeply influenced by both of them, and so many others, as you said, Austen, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Henry James, of course, as well. You can find elements of all of them. You know, they. These figures do haunt her novels to a greater or lesser degree. And if you're interested in reading those classics, you will be interested in reading Murdoch.
Definitely. Definitely.
So I think, Kevin, that the jury's out, maybe, and into whether she's quite on a par with the really big names of the of 200, 300, 400 years ago. But I think she's certainly going to be a canonical figure for the post Second World War scene.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Our second question. Marcus asks, in A Fairly Honourable Defeat, Murdoch assigns astrological birth signs on several of the characters, and they discuss the subject somewhat knowledgeably. Does she give evidence of interest in the subject in other works? Wow. Now, I mean, we're going from a very general, broad question to a very specific one here, aren't we?
And I've done quite a lot of kind of checking of the things that I've got access to, at least on my kind of note taking. It's not something that's kind of registered in my mind, I suppose, before. But I kind of did quickly look back at A Fairly Honourable Defeat, and yes, noticed this. I kind of noticed that now that it's been pointed out to me. So I suppose maybe this is one of these areas that, at least, in the kind of academic space, hasn't been explored as much. I mean, there are other researchers that have explored maybe kind of related topics, so topics related to the occult and things like that.
Yes, absolutely.
So Rob Hardy, for example, who's also been on the podcast before, has done research on Murdoch's engagement with the occult, with Jung and archetypes. And he also gave a lecture on Murdoch's engagement with tarot cards not that long ago. So I suppose that might be a slightly related thing. But yeah, it seems like Murdoch's interest in astrological signs might be a new area for us to be looking at, or for some new researcher to be looking at.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by this question because, like you, it wasn't something that I'd got from my reading of that particular novel, A Fairly Honourable Defeat, before. But going back and looking at it now, I mean, I wouldn't say it's an essential part of the work, but it's interesting that it's part of the discussion. I mean, there's a sense perhaps that it's a little bit, should we say, of an add-on to a middle class life, perhaps, of something that maybe is treated not maybe with disdain, maybe a little bit of an element of comedy in it. But as you say, there is a kind of a running thread of the occult right the way through Murdoch's work. And I'm glad you mentioned Rob Hardy, who's visiting fellow at the research centre at Chichester here. He's got a chapter on that coming out in a book that we've got coming out later this year called Iris Murdoch and the Western Theological Imagination. So that he's writing that at the moment. A couple of years ago, I wrote a chapter looking at Murdoch on the supernatural, and trace that the start really back to the sandcastle. Do you remember when Felicity is doing her spells on the beach, and
Yes,
she's
yeah.
using some form of magic? She's using those kinds of elements, putting cards together, putting magical spells together, and trying to kind of summon up spirits, or spirit summon up the spirit of the dead dog. It's a very that's quite a strange novel. I know we may well talk about it later,
Yeah,
but
definitely.
it goes right the way through to certainly to A Green Knight. I don't know if it goes into Jackson's Dilemma, but it's something that Murdoch doesn't use in every novel, but she picks her moments to use it, doesn't she?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, so yes, I did. I also kind of tried as best as I could with our current, documents that we can search in various ways to see if astrology comes up in any other places. And I couldn't see it in any of the kind of letters or the journals or in kind of like in Peter Conradi's autobiography, not autobiography, which is where it may have kind of come up. But then, yeah, perhaps there's more work to be done. Perhaps other novels will kind of reveal an interest in this. I do, as you say, think part of it is kind of, I don't know, maybe to kind of, it's a kind of interesting thing that Simon seems to be in. It's something that the character Simon seems to be interested in, that character, and it's kind of something that kind of gives us a kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of something kind of a kind of interesting way of reading people, I suppose, is what she's kind of trying to play with there. That Simon has, and he is kind of fairly good at reading people, but kind of not good at listening to his own kind of intuition or something like that. But yeah, perhaps seems like there might be more work to be done there.
Yes, I think so. It's probably questioning about where we place our attention,
Yeah.
probably. Do we place it on the occult astrological signs, or do we actually place it on human beings? But anyway, as you say, much more to be done on that. So the question, it probably has a much fuller answer if we'd had more time to do more reading.
Yeah.
Great. Right. Next question. Matt asks, do we know if Simone de Beauvoir read Murdoch? Does she mention Murdoch anywhere in her writings? And did any other existentialists reply to Murdoch's criticisms of their views?
Yeah, this
That's.
is again another interesting question. There's a kind of some of this I don't feel like I have the right kind of research kind of knowledge to go on. I'm not sure that de Beauvoir did read Murdoch. I think they exchanged letters. Or I think that Murdoch tried to meet her once and she wasn't able to get a meeting with her, which I think she was a little bit disappointed about. That I did notice that there's a kind of comical exchange between Murdoch and one of her friends and for a short time lovers, Bridget Brophy, where she kind of jokingly says something like about, oh, well, if you bump into de Beauvoir, tell her, we should have, it would have been nice to meet her or something like that. There's a kind of comical aside. So I think maybe she would have liked to have had a conversation with de Beauvoir, but
Oh,
it seemed like
absolutely.
she didn't. As far as kind of now that I think about it, I didn't think about how her writing is engaged within Murdoch's work. I think again, possibly others are better at doing that. I think you've written on Simone de Beauvoir and Murdoch
I
before,
have,
haven't you?
I mean, that was looking at notions of ethics in terms of sexual relations within the Mandarins and Black Prince. And looking at them in kind of in conversation, really. There's certainly no evidence at all that Beauvoir read Murdoch. I think the cultural difference, only flowed one way. I think obviously Murdoch was re read Sartre, Beauvoir, Kuno, Lacan. She read Derrida, read all of them, of course, in French, although she did have some translations later on. And they had, this probably fairly common knowledge. It's such an important influence on her, and from 1945, when she met Sartre twice in Brussels, right the way through to the early 50s, when she publishes Sartre Romantic Rationalist, when she's kind of dispensed or at least moved away from existentialism. So there's that kind of there's 5 or 6 years where she's kind of really deeply invested in thinking about it. As you say, she wrote to Beauvoir, asking for a meeting, and we know that letter exists, because it's been republished in Living on Paper in 2015. But she never got a response, which kind of strikes me. Well, how do we know that? How did that letter still come to exist? I'm not sure, but I think Murdoch was quite keen to meet Sartre again in Paris, and perhaps he said to her, "Well, if you want to set up a meeting with me, you have to go through Simone." And so Murdoch tried to meet both of them, but I think Beauvoir was really kind of wary about another young female philosopher meeting Sartre, and being kind of not exactly usurped, but somebody else being in that circle. I think she wanted to be a little bit more protective of him, and particularly post 45. Existentialism is exploding. It's both major celebrities, aren't they, from the from that point onwards? And there's so many different calls on their time. Murdoch, as we know, reviewed Beauvoir's The Ethics of Ambiguity in 1950. Which is probably the best place to start for that kind of that engagement. You can find that in that review in Existentialists and Mystics, actually. So it's easy to get hold of. But as far as other existentialists replying to Murdoch's criticisms of their views, I can't think of any. So if anybody is listening to the podcast and knows of some, please do write in and let us know, because we'd be fascinated, as would the Matt who asked the question, I'm sure.
I can't think of any existentialists replying directly to her either. I think there are people beginning to research this in a bit more detail now. I have a feeling that a researcher that was at the conference that we last had in the Murdoch space in Paris, Matt Congdon, I think he's starting to try and think about this kind of Murdoch's engagement with existentialism in a slightly kind of broader sense. So saying, well, what does she mean by existentialism? Is it the same kind of existentialism as others, or the kind of core group of existentialists would agree with? How does she kind of sit in that space? And that kind of research project or those questions might lead to a kind of better answer to that question that we've had from this Matt here. So,
Yeah, I've got an inclination they might be the same. I think they may well be the same. So if they are,
The same
Matt,
Matt.
thank you for your research. Keep going. I'm sure it will be fruitful. And I'm pretty sure that there must be some existentialists responding to Murdoch's critique in the mid-50s, surely. So, but we'll, that's research that needs to be done. So thank you for that. Okay, question four. David asks, to what extent are changing ways of reading Murdoch's novels mere fashion? And how much they have to do with what someone might refer to as academic work. Interesting.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting one. I suppose this, in a way, is kind of relating to that first question we had. We've already kind of started to think about kind of what is the relationship between the kind of academic world and Murdoch, and what is the relationship between that and the kind of general reader's fashion and kind of what it means to be a fashionable novelist or a popular novelist in the general sense. I mean, I do think that Murdoch's been gaining interest over the years in the academic space for a while. I mean, obviously the Iris
Definitely.
Murdoch Society's been growing in numbers over the years. So is the kind of there's an Iris Murdoch Appreciation Facebook page that's been kind of growing in numbers over the years. We obviously have a podcast which we never used to have. So, I mean, there are obviously some things which are growing in popularity, which would suggest that she is popular beyond an academic space and in an academic space.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's not just the fiction as well. It's the philosophy, isn't it, as well? I think there's been such a the thing that struck me over the last 5 years since Murdoch's centenary in 2019 is really the vast increase in the numbers of people that are working on her philosophy in all sorts of different ways, and all sorts of different territories as well. I mean, yes, there has been substantive growth in America and in the UK, but certainly Europe, China, South America, and elsewhere, there seems to be more people getting on board and thinking that Murdoch isn't just somebody who's useful to answer a particular question or have a response to a question about aesthetics or about attention. You don't just need to include her in the debate, but actually you can frame a debate around what Murdoch says. I was having a conversation with somebody in Paris a couple of weeks ago at that conference you mentioned, and he said to me that that's the major change, actually, that people are taking Murdoch's entire vision and all of her philosophical work much more seriously. It's not such a niche or a niche thing to do anymore. It's become much more, shall we say, suitable to the philosophical landscape. But
Yeah.
certainly, I mean, the question asks about reading Murdoch's novels, whether it's fashion, and I think for the general readership, I don't know how much academic work really impacts on that. So I think if you just, if you're just a general reader and you go into a bookshop and you pick up your next Murdoch for a couple of quid off the shelf and your paperback and you go and read it, I don't think it's going to, the ongoing debate around who killed Bradley Pearson, for example, isn't really going to figure that much. But I suppose for a certain number of people who are very interested in reading the latest work in the Iris Murdoch Review or collections of works or journals, then yes, it probably, slowly, slowly over time. But I think that the change is glacial, isn't it, really? And really, in the end, it's the reader's response to, where they want to take that reading.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting to think how kind of what how does the kind an academic writing about Murdoch relate to kind of the popular space? And I mean, I think sometimes sometimes it's actually it ends up being valuable if we're kind of literary critics to kind of help people to see how a I don't know how a novel speaks to contemporary problems in different ways. And so in that sense, the academic
That's
world
important.
can help to kind of energize the kind of general readership, the world of the general readership. So it means that academics might kind of start to say, well, hang on, look at this. We have novels that are engaging with ecological matters in interesting ways, or with kind of homosexuality and gender in interesting ways, or even with politics. Or even as kind of a kind of we've got a newer researcher who I think has joined the Iris Murdoch Centre on neurodiversity. So we do have these areas that Murdoch's novels can and do speak to. And so as we kind of start to think about those in kind of broader terms, that I think maybe will start to kind of leak into the kind of general readership world and kind of go, oh, actually, I can read this novel because it tells me something about a neurodiverse experience.
Yes, and I think that which is really good. I mean, that kind of question about public engagement and impact, how important those are for academia and have been for a number of years, but the kind of the importance to universities and to funding bodies, Arts and Humanities Research Council and British Academy and stuff, this idea of having an impact on people outside of the university bubble or the academic sphere or whatever is so important. And I think that's a real skill for you and me and for other academics is to be able to do that. And to write for a popular audience, or to write for newspapers, magazines, or non-traditional media as well, or podcasts, digital writing, whatever it might be, to kind of get our ideas out there and to suggest how important they are. Because I think it's going to be Murdoch's fiction is going to be increasingly valuable to help illuminate our understanding of the 20th century as well as where we are today, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of, yeah, I mean, the kind of academic world often talks about the importance of kind of impact. And I mean, it's easy to think of that in kind of, I don't know, in scientific studies where, I've found that X helps, reduce rates of cancer, that kind of thing. I've made an impact in society. Whereas for the kind of literary critic, it is about kind of engaging with different spaces and kind of saying, actually, we can kind of advocate for Murdoch in these different kind of environments. And also remind people that her fiction does speak to kind of different subjects. And yeah, definitely, I think it's important to especially as we kind of move further away from the 20th century, I think we can start to see Murdoch's novels also as responding to a particular historical period.
Yes.
So, you know, we kind of see that Murdoch is engaging with kind of religion or with kind of spirituality in a secular world, and that's quite interesting and unique for its time. She's also engaging with things like, you know, 1960s counterculture. You know, we've got characters that are kind of, you know, exhibiting kind of anti-establishment ideas or kind of questioning modes of authority. We've got, you know, some of them engaging with psychoactive drugs. You know, some of them are quite bohemian. Some of them are interested in kind of non-Western religious ideas, Buddhism and stuff like that. And so I think in that sense, the novels kind of can become interesting to kind of respond to from a historical perspective. Also things like cultural and kind of sexual liberalism, you know, lots of our characters talking about free love or kind of engaging in
Or
love
engaging
affairs,
in it, yeah.
extramarital relationships, adultery, all of that. So I think all of that kind of, I think I've heard people say before that, you know, does do things like that kind of date Murdoch's novels, and I think, or and therefore make them less fashionable. But I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. I think actually those are things that can allow us to say, to see the text as a product of its history, and as responding to a particular historical period, which means that, you know, maybe someone who kind of knew about London in the 1960s and 70s can read those novels with nostalgia. But someone who was born in 2000 can read them and go, oh, look at that. I'm getting a taste of the 60s and 70s, you know, and kind of, and the power cuts that were happening in the 1970s, and the fact that, you know, all these characters using soda siphons, what are those? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of that 60s, 70s technology. Those sort of new consumer items, I suppose, which we don't really think too much. I certainly haven't thought too much about Murdoch and consumer and material culture so much, but it's certainly there, in fashion as well, I think, right from the beginning. What people are, what Anna's wearing in Under the Net, or what Dora's wearing in The Bell. They do, you know, they do bring out a certain interest in that culture. But as you say, we can also think about them in terms of issues of politics, feminism, where we are at the moment with our views on gender and sexuality, and how they can speak to us today, and what they might say to us about our 21st century as well. So yeah, important. But to sort of, I suppose, to circle back to the question, this question about fashion is interesting. I think there are kind of waves of how Murdoch is read, and then we kind of get a kind of a countervision. So it'll be interesting to see, certainly as we get more of an uptick in people reading Murdoch's fiction, as you say, in different ways, particularly interesting, as you say, but in neurodiversity, that's, or thinking about Murdoch and love and attention, again, in light of where we are, I think it'll be, we'll have different readings and different kind of visions of the novels. So thank you, David, for the question. Question five. Mary asks, Iris seemed to say that philosophy and fiction were totally separate things. Is this borne out in her work or not? And I presume Mary's thinking about the novels rather than the philosophy, although we can probably try and tackle both, although it is a big question.
Yeah, it is a big question, and I mean it's, you know, a kind of question that is kind of ever present in Murdoch studies, you know, this kind of question of, is Murdoch a philosophical novelist? You know,
Yeah, been going since the 19 since A.S. Byatt and Peter Wolfe wrote the first books on Murdoch back in the 60s.
yes, exactly. It's and she's responded to it many times in interviews, you know, and sometimes quite vehemently, or kind of,
Indeed.
you know, where she kind of was clearly not very happy about the kind of line of questioning. I think that maybe the kind of question, is Murdoch a philosophical novelist, kind of hinges on maybe two things. So I suppose it means it kind of hinges on what Murdoch might mean by philosophical novelist, and also by kind of, do we actually, it is, does Murdoch differentiate these two mediums in very clear ways in practice? It seems to me like Murdoch kind of conceived of the idea of the philosophical novelist on a kind of Sartrean mode, so that, you know, the kind of the idea of a writer presenting a particular view through narrative and plot. And so she would say in interviews, for example, that good novelists, for instance, Sartre, are damaged by a desire to put across a philosophical creed. So for her, that kind of that activity damages the novel because it means that there's a sense in which the author ends up speaking through the novel.
Yes, that kind of didacticism, that kind of we're going to hit you over the head with this idea, and all of the characters are ciphers for these ideas, and it's just going to play out in a particular way, right? Which for most, the vast majority of novels that do that, they fail because they're really rather dull.
And I mean, and Murdoch clearly doesn't want that. You know, it's kind of it's an imposition of the character of the author over, you know, the freedom of the characters and over the freedom of the reader. You know, so the didacticism of a 19th century novel is more about getting us to kind of, you know, think about a problem in moral terms and play around in that space and see, do we agree or disagree? You know, have we learned something new? Whereas the kind of the didacticism of a kind of the philosophical novelist proper, as Murdoch would disagree with them, is someone that, yeah, is kind of telling us to think a particular way. And that's not something she liked. And so I think that obviously is why she responded to that question, are you a philosophical novelist, often in a negative way. So she would say, you know, she would deny the idea that her novels expressed a philosophy, that her novels were philosophical novels, or that she was a philosophical novelist. And she argued instead that the artists should kind of follow their instinct and not try to be kind of didactic or like teachers in their art. They should kind of do the thing and start
And I think
writing
that's
it.
absolutely fair enough. And yeah, I think there's also a kind of a practical element to it, or maybe more pragmatic element, because a lot of the interviews that she was doing, obviously for Sunday Times or for for major publications, I think when people asked her this, she was quite aware of who the readership would be, people who would pick up this or read it over breakfast on a Sunday morning, the next in a few weeks' time. To find out, what the next Murdoch novel was going to be, I think they would be put off if she said, "Well, yes, I am a philosophical novelist." I think it would reduce her readership quite substantially. So I think she always had that in mind, that she wanted to have something in her novels for everyone, and that if she said that they were, had a particular focus, then her readership would very likely drop.
Definitely. I mean, she does say in kind of other areas something along the lines of, well, I want them to the novels to be kind of I want people to be able to read them deeply if they want to do that, but I also want them to be read just as a good story, just as a good
Yes.
yarn, you know, to kind of to have a bit of fun. So, you know, if you're being kind of presented as a philosophical novelist, then that might mean that your novels then look like they're very cerebral, and you have to be a philosopher to make sense of them.
Exactly
And
so.
of course, that's not what her novels are. So I think that in that sense, that's kind of that reason why she doesn't want to be called a philosophical novelist. But whether or not there is a huge difference between the mediums is also a different kind of question, I suppose. I mean, she would certainly in interviews and in her philosophy. In her philosophical writing, say that they were doing quite different things. So, you know, literature is about kind of being entertaining, and
Yeah,
it's
it
about
does many, many
fun.
things, doesn't it? Literature.
Yeah, and it can do all of that stuff in lots of different ways. But philosophy has to be much more direct. You know, it's about kind of yeah, it's about exploring a problem in a particular way, in a particular voice. There's not as much fun or kind of playing around in the text.
No.
And the reader is obviously being asked to accept particular points of view and, you know, as presented by the writer. And obviously, that is a very different thing to literature.
Yes, she says that philosophy is there to clarify and literature is there to mystify. Or she
Yeah.
says, and she said, I think it's in the McGee interview, isn't it? Where she said
It is.
in 77, she says it entertains, it's for fun, full of tricks and magic. And that philosophy is abstract, it's direct, and it mustn't leave any space for a sort of readily interpreted. It must tell you exactly what it's doing.
Absolutely. So I think, I mean, that gives us a sense then that, so that, you know, so in this sense we might see that fiction and philosophy, going back to Mary's question, are quite separate things. But then of course there's the kind of it, you know, we can start to kind of say, okay, well, but how does philosophy make its way into things like fiction? And that's when the kind of question starts to get a bit harder to answer. Or maybe it doesn't get harder to answer. You know, Murdoch would say things like, yeah, there is, you know, there are theories and philosophical ideas that come into the novel, but they do that as part of the fun. And also, she would kind of say in different spaces. I think in one interview she said she phrases it as a bit like saying, well, if I were a fisherman, you know, I'd write about fishing. but I'm a philosopher, so I'm able to write about philosophy. So that means that characters in her novels are going to talk about philosophy. If she was a fisher, if she did fishing, then her characters would be talking about fishing. So she's just,
Yeah, or shipbuilding, or
she's using the knowledge that she has to kind of put into the novels. I think the only place where it might get a bit more kind of complicated is when, is where she does, there is one case in her kind of oeuvre where she does turn a piece of philosophy into literature. So she ends up writing The Fire and the Sun, a study of why Plato banished the artist in 1977. And shortly after that being published, a National Gallery director read it, enjoyed it, and then approached her to say, oh, could you turn that into a play? And she originally kind of said no, but then eventually she put herself to the task. I think all of this is kind of explained in an interview by the director. Is it Michael Costo, in the
might well be.
Gillian Dooley book?
Yes.
So she originally thought, no, I can't do that. And then she did. She wrote a Platonic dialogue based or influenced by the ideas in that philosophical work. So in that sense, kind of philosophy becomes fiction in a different way. But yeah, she would, I suspect, kind of question that in various ways. The dialogue form is not quite the same as a novel. It's harder to kind of for a, there's no narrator giving us a kind of didactic lead through the story in a dialogue. We're hearing different voices, and that means that we're in a sense maybe being led through the kind of thinking processes that a novel might allow us to do in other spaces.
Yes, of course. I mean, there are lots of different ways of reading a Murdoch novel. And if you are interested in philosophy, you can see, or if you know something about philosophy, you will see philosophical ideas being played around with, as you say. Occasionally, you get big chunks of philosophy being dumped into into fiction. I'm thinking of the opening of chapter 15 in The Time of the Angels, where you just get that big
Oh yes. Yeah,
chunk
the
of
Heidegger.
Heidegger. There are moments where she quite clearly is asking you to look at a particular philosophical idea, or characters might have a philosophical exchange, right? Or it might be a case of a particular character failing to kind of live up to expectations, or being an ego-ridden monster. We've got plenty of those in Murdoch's fiction, and she kind of gently kind of suggests how they have failed in particular ways. Also, I just thought, of course, in Metaphysics of the Guide to Morals, she makes a mention of Under the Net and calls that a philosophical novel. She actually reflects on her first novel. I think maybe that's why she didn't like it so much, even though, of course, it's very, very popular with readers. She didn't like that novel later on, and was particularly upset when people thought it was one of the better ones.
I mean, I suppose maybe it's also that she kind of, I mean, there are other novels as well that when she talks about kind of differentiating them in style between a kind of open novel and a closed novel, so a closed novel being something that's kind of based around a particular theme or idea. So she'll
Yeah.
kind of describe something like The Time of the Angels as being a more closed novel because it's about a particular thing. But I maybe yeah that so there are some novels that kind of feel like they're centered around a particular theme or idea, but I'm not sure that necessarily makes them philosophical, perhaps.
Yeah, and of course there are a lot of philosophers within her novels. Both there are professional philosophers like John Robert Rossinanoff in Philosopher's Pupil, but there's also Sunday philosophers, aren't there? There was that fantastic paper a few weeks ago at that conference in Paris on them, and there's so many of them, that these particularly men, sort of men, middle-aged men turning their hand to philosophy. We can think of examples in Fairly Honourable Defeat, in Time of the
Marcus
Angels as
Fisher,
well. Yeah, Marcus
The
Fisher, Time
Time
of
of
the
the
Angels,
Angels,
and quite often they may well be dealing with the same kind of ideas that Murdoch's are, or writing papers that sound like, or are directly related to other some of Murdoch's philosophical essays. So there, I think she's kind of having a kind of a she's reflecting and maybe poking fun at herself, or suggesting that some of these ideas maybe in the fictional space don't work as well. That interests me a lot.
Definitely. I mean, and but I suppose that again, it's kind of back to that thing where again, she might almost be poking fun at herself, so it's
Yeah. Did
It's
that
about
element.
that kind of having fun in a kind of literary space, whereas in the philosophical space, you're not doing that in the same way. So I suppose in that sense, we get it does feel, at least I think, that philosophy is not, Murdoch treats philosophy and fiction in different ways.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And they are kind of borne out in her work in different ways, but there's certainly, if you want to explore the relationship and find a relationship between the two of them, you can do that. But you don't have to.
No, you
So,
don't have to. You don't have to know anything about philosophy to enjoy the novel,
no.
certainly. And of course, in the philosophy itself, there is storytelling. I mean, the classic example of M and D, mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. The image of the kestrel is a little story. In Metaphysics of Guide to Morals, there are references to all kinds of to characters and ideas, both real and imagined. So there is a kind of a there's a movement, I think, within Murdoch's thought. I always, I know that she likes to split them, and she liked to when she was writing, she liked to split her day so that she spent the early part of the day working on the philosophy, and then she moved on to the fiction. But because she, all of this, this and the poetry and the plays and everything else is coming out of one mind. It's all part of the same, in a sense, for me, having worked on Murdoch for 20 years, it's all now part of the same experience, and trying to find sort of connections and draw links between them is such a fascinating way to consider her work now.
I think so too. I mean, I think I can see why she might have kind of wanted them to be seen as very separate
Of
enterprises,
course, yeah.
but I definitely think that that boundary is porous. It's there are things that leak both ways, and I mean, and the other thing as well, I think that's worth kind of remembering is so that. When Murdoch says things like, "Oh no, I'm not a philosophical novelist," because she doesn't want people to be kind of scared by the philosophy or kind of put off by too much cerebral kind of thought,
Yes.
I mean, sometimes that's also kind of actually a part of the novel. Like the fact that when we get that piece of Heidegger given to us in The Time of the Angels, it's also there as a way of another character going, "Oh goodness me, what the hell does that mean?"
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And I don't know what it means, and it just seems odd, So now, of course, we might then be able to make further links to it, kind of on a philosophical basis, and that would be interesting in another way. But that it's kind of operating on two levels, isn't it? On the one hand, it's kind of just part of the conversation, part of a novel, the way the novel works, and on the other hand, it might have a relationship to the kind of deeper ideas underlying the novel.
Yes. Yeah, and I think we ought to, and we will at some point have a whole podcast dedicated to this subject because it is a fascinating one. As you
Yeah, it
say,
is.
it's been a debate that's been running for decades, and a lot of people have written a lot of stuff on it. And
Definitely.
myself included. And it does need to be revisited in a bigger
And it's
context. But
interesting to see how some novels do get called philosophical more than others. Like you say, so like if Under the Net, do we think of that as being more philosophical because Murdoch said it? On Wikipedia, it lists The Sea, the Sea as a philosophical novel, and I'm not sure I would necessarily see that as an overtly philosophical novel. But that
No,
again
I
is all
think
part of
there
that
are,
interesting question. And yeah, definitely something that we could probably spend an entire series of podcasts thinking about.
yeah, absolutely, and we will cover the Sea of the Sea at some point in some detail too, but I think you're right. I think this is a topic that we need to come back to. And she's certainly not a philosophical novelist in the sense that Sartre is, but it
No.
depends how you want to, but do you want to take that definition of philosophical novelist just like that? I think there are obviously different definitions, and we could play around with this. We could play around with that idea for ages, and I'd be very happy to. But
Yeah.
we've got to move on because
Do.
we know time is pressing, of course, as it always is in the podcast. And we've got a few more questions to get through. So, question six: Austin asks, "I'd like to know more about which of her contemporaries she admired most as a reader, and the writers she hated reading." And quite often, she said that she didn't read her contemporaries, didn't she, Dan? But I don't think that's quite right.
She would say so. I mean, it's a question that she did get asked here and there in kind of interviews or discussions with people, and she does talk about it in her writings every now and then. I mean, so in 1990, 1991, Jeffrey Myers in an interview does ask her the same question, Which contemporary writers do you respect? He said. And her answer was, I don't really read contemporary writers very much. But then she also adds, but for instance, I enjoyed reading Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Ishiguro's A Pale View of Hills, and A.S. Byatt's wonderful novel Possession. She also, in other kind of areas, then talks about things like writers like John Cooper Powers, not quite a contemporary, but almost, I think maybe. He's writing
Yeah, a
in
little
the
bit
early
earlier, but
20th century. So she was reading her contemporaries. So even though she's saying I don't read contemporary writers very much, she is reading them.
I mean, she obviously had a long-standing relationship for about 10 years with Bridget Brophy and read her novels. We know that she read Angela Carter. And that she wasn't particularly keen on Angela Carter, for example. I mean, there are plenty of others. Obviously, you've mentioned Byatt. Obviously, Byatt and Murdoch had a very close friendship, and Murdoch inspired Byatt quite early on. Obviously, she read Elizabeth Bowen. Obviously, the generation prior to her, but Bowen had an influence on Murdoch's Irish novels, as we talked about on the Iris Murdoch and Ireland podcast quite some time ago. But Murdoch also had an influence on one of Elizabeth Bowen's novels, I think Eva Trout, her final novel. So there's a kind of a mutual kind of respect and respect there. But Iris read Muriel Spark. We know that she read Doris Lessing. So when she says that she doesn't read contemporaries, I think she's being a little bit disingenuous. But she certainly did spend most of her time reading her favourites, reading the your Henry Jameses, your Dostoevskys, and so on.
And I mean, she did read other novelists around her era. I mean, so I think part of the other thing that's interesting is she, in that same interview with Geoffrey Myers, talks about how quite a lot of her contemporaries are ones she was also friends with. So the benefit she got from those friendships were less about kind of going, I really enjoy your novel, and more about kind of general friendships, benefits that you get from that. So she noted that she was friends with people like Kingsley Amis, A.S. Byatt, as we've already mentioned, A.N. Wilson, Andrew Harvey, Bernice Rubens, and Vikram Seth. So she kind of has lots of these friends that are important to her on levels more than just the literary.
Of course. Josephine Hart's Damage as well. She reviewed and was friends. In fact, of course, Josephine Hart produced Murdoch's The Black Prince on the West End. There's yeah, there is a lot more there, I think, than she usually talks about. And that's that Mayer's interview is a good one for pulling those memories.
I mean, as far as the writer she hated, that's a slightly different kind of question. And I mean, I don't think she ever necessarily says that she openly hates a writer. I think she'll say that she dislikes things about particular writers. So again, in that same Myers interview, she says that she likes John Cooper Powers. She says that he's particularly good for his engagement with sex. But she says that he does that much better than D.H. Lawrence. Now, D.H. Lawrence, she'll say in other places she wasn't a particular fan of. So she'll say that she admired his work. She thought he was a great writer, a marvelous writer, maybe even a genius, but that he wasn't her favorite author. And she felt that because that she felt that his writing was a bit too kind of closed, a bit too kind of, maybe a bit too egotistical. And I suppose in this sense, it actually relates in a way to that discussion we were saying about the philosophical novelist. The philosophical novelist is limiting their novel to a particular perspective that is of interest to them. And what she's saying is that D.H. Lawrence is, I suppose, in a sense, doing something similar, but from a kind of, from a kind of a perspective of kind of, he has a particular view that he wants to put across through his characters, and it means that some of those characters don't come across well. So she ends up saying that Lady Chatterley's lover is spoiled by Lawrence's vile contempt for poor old Clifford Chatterley. So he's made into a kind of horrid and contemptible character rather than someone interesting and curious. Because Lawrence is anxious to persuade us of a particular view. So that kind of thing she wasn't a fan of. I think she was also critical of, in a similar way, of writers like Orwell. Again, they're kind of the political novel might sometimes do things in a different way to the kind of novel that she wants to achieve, but she didn't hate him or dislike him. I
She just
don't.
realized, I think, that that form of the novel was not for her. I think
Yeah.
she says the same sorts of things about George Eliot, that she admired it but couldn't ever love it. And it's interesting that quite often there is some writing that says, well, Murdoch in a sense is George Eliot for the post-war era, which I always think is a bit strange because they do share some similarities, but not that many. But they're obviously both fantastic writers. But I can understand why Murdoch, was left a little bit cold by Daniel Deronda and Middlemarch, perhaps.
And there are other kind of there are other writers that she, I mean, she's, again, we've mentioned already that she kind of distanced herself from writers like Virginia Woolf and James Joyce. She didn't say that she disliked them. She just didn't,
Yeah.
would prefer to use a different literary model when it comes to writing a fiction.
It
She was,
depends what, and it depends when you caught her as well. In her early in interviews in the 50s, she praises Joyce, doesn't she? And yet later on, kind of leaves him behind. Same with Woolf. She said she didn't, she enjoyed some of them some of her novels earlier in the earlier when she was younger. But when as she grew up, she grew older, she just didn't find the benefit in reading them anymore.
I mean, I found one exchange that I found particularly interesting in one interview, a very early one, where she ends up saying that if I've kind of, I'm kind of summarizing her ideas here, so I think I'm right. So she ends up saying that the kind of creative extremes of self-indulgence that you might find in a writer like Genet, and perhaps she might say a similar things about Lawrence. So there's a kind of self-indulgent attitude going on there. You know, in his, the way he's shaping his characters, she ends up saying that that kind of self-indulgence is not easy to get away with as a writer, even if you make the object kind of beautiful and look good, you know, and that it kind of is attractive for the reader to read or fun for the reader to read. It's difficult to get away with that kind of self-indulgence, and the interviewer then at that point ends up saying, "You're not going to write Pale Fire or A Naked Lunch." So those are the first one being by Nabokov, the second by William S. Burroughs, and she responds quite, it seems, quite quickly, "No, God forbid, at least not in the case of the latter. No, I don't think so." So she doesn't want to do something that's overtly experimental, you know, in that
Yeah.
sense, trying to distance herself from the kind of experimental work, which I think for her sometimes in that kind of modernist or kind of experimental writing phase can end up looking a bit self-indulgent or a bit kind of not concerned with the social world that she's interested in.
Sure. And we know that, for example, she deeply admired Nabokov. She wrote in support of Lolita being published in the UK, and she, arguably it's one of the intertexts of The Black Prince. And she read it, and she would have read Pale Fire, I'm sure, because her husband John Bailey was a big fan of Nabokov and published, and they had copies of all the novels in the house. I'm not sure whether she would have ever read Naked Lunch. I can't imagine Murdoch reading Burroughs, can you?
Well, she does meant, I think she had, she, there's suggestion that she may have done. There's a, the
Really?
work I've done on the Book of Job, where Murdoch gave a talk or responded to a talk on the Book of Job in the 1960s, at the University of at University College Dublin. Is that right? I think so. In that interview, there's someone who gives a kind of there's someone who gives a review of her presence there and says that she makes some comparison about Burroughs and Rauschenberg, and kind of types of art. So maybe she did read it, or at the very least, she had a sense of the way it worked or the kind of way the art was being constructed. But yeah, I'm not sure. I get the impression maybe she had read Pale Fire, maybe she hadn't read Naked Lunch, but knew what it was about, so to speak.
Possibly. Yeah, it's difficult, very
But yeah, I
difficult to know,
think
isn't it? Yeah.
he is somewhere on her radar, so perhaps she did read
Sure.
him.
Yeah. I mean,
I mean, there are.
she had some connections to that world. Yeah. Great. Well, again, there's so much more that we could probably say about her,
There
but we're
is.
not
I
going
mean,
to.
she was a great fan of Tolkien as well, which is
Yes, of
a
course.
and had his writing desk. So, you know, there are lots of other writers that she was a fan of. She kept trying to share Lord of the Rings with people, I think, by the sounds of it. If you look at some of her letters, she's kind of keeping in touch with people saying, "Have you read Lord of the Rings yet? Have you read Lord of the Rings yet?" So that's quite funny. But
She does that a lot in her letters, doesn't she? She so presses books on people. Which is another way that we can trace her influences and also what she's been reading. Right, best move on because we've got a couple more questions to end with. So, question seven, Peter asks, did Kierkegaard influence Murdoch's writing and thinking? And the answer, Peter, is yes, he did. In fact, if you have a look, if you've got a copy of Metaphysics: The Guide to Morals, you can find that Kierkegaard is quite well represented in the index. So I direct you to that. He's also referenced in a number of the essays in Existentialists and Mystics. So you might want to get hold of a copy of that. There has been some work done on Kierkegaard's influence. So Murdoch's copies of The Seducer's Diary and Either Or are in the archives at Kingston. They've been well annotated. So we would probably direct you to that. Certainly our friend and former podcast guest Scott H. Moore at Baylor University in Texas has done some work on Kierkegaard. But also there's a really interesting essay in the collection Iris Murdoch Connected linking Kierkegaard's Seducer's Diary with Murdoch's Black Prince. So that might be somewhere to have a look at first, as well as the original writings in Existentialists and Mystics and Metaphysics: The Guide to Morals. So it's there. Some work has been done, but not as much as you might imagine. I can't think of any more. Can you, Dan?
No, I couldn't come up with anything else. Again, not quite my area. The only other thing I mean, I did notice one paper listed elsewhere by a writer called Paul Martins from 2012. In a book on called Kierkegaard's Influence on Philosophy, he writes a chapter on Iris Murdoch. So
Oh.
and Kierkegaard. So there are some people who've written about it, and there are some people who've engaged with it. But yeah, I'm not sure I know enough to kind of quantify what that influence would have been on her
I
writing,
think
though.
it's probably fair to say he wasn't as important to her as Wittgenstein and Plato, clearly, Heidegger, her kind of her major kind of figures that she engaged with. But maybe not quite as important to her as Schopenhauer either, of which there's been some work written on Schopenhauer. But certainly if you kind of start to have a look through her own writings, I think you'll probably find that there is some material quite an enough material to be getting on with. So yeah, the answer is yes, he certainly did influence it. And so pick up the books and have a read. That was a nice easy one to answer, wasn't it? Finally then, to finish off our questions. Joe asks, what do you think is the most underrated work by Iris? Real personal preference, I think. So, Dan, what would yours be?
I do struggle with this, and sometimes it changes over different kind of in different periods of time. So I think there are probably some novels that are kind of considered to be kind of underrated, at least in the academic space, or kind of under discussed. So a novel like The Sandcastle or An Unofficial Rose, I think they're both fairly underrated. But I mean, I one of my favorites, which I think in some ways is still overrated, underrated, because I think there's so much more that it could offer, is A Fairly Honorable Defeat. I just think that's a brilliant novel. And it has been discussed quite a lot in the critical space. But I think it's a novel that always kind of gives a bit more. I suppose others would also talk about kind of some of the later novels that are much longer, so things like The Philosopher's Pupil or The Book and the Brotherhood. The Philosopher's Pupil is definitely very good too, but
Yes, all great choices. I think there are some novels for me that have been had less written about that had less written about them really. The Sandcastle, but would be one obviously quite maligned when it came out as a kind of a middle brow piece of women's magazine fiction. I think there's having written on it and spoken on it in the last year or two, there's so much more going on. Same with the Unofficial Rose as well, her sixth novel.
yeah, I think both of those, that kind
Yeah,
of
Henry and
idea that they were.
Cato, love that book. Henry and Cato was John Bailey's favourite of Murdoch's novels. I think there's so little that's been written on that. Fabulous.
I mean, even a novel like An Accidental Man, I think is which has such an unusual structure and such a brilliant concept for a structure. You know, it's kind of based around You have a party with lots of voices that are difficult to differentiate from each other. Then you have a section of letters. Then you have kind of standard narrative material. And it's such a really kind of interesting way of being taken through a novel. And even that in itself is something that I don't think has been discussed that much, although maybe others have and I've not noticed it.
It's certainly not. The problem is when you've got 26 novels plus all the everything else, it's not like a Wolf's works or Austen's works where they are quite, there aren't as many as they do, there's been so much written on them in the past. There are these novels that are both underrated critically, but also have, but which for general readership, I think those ones that we've mentioned, but also have had so little sort of critical attention given to them really since they've been published. You do get the odd essay, but in general, people do tend to stick to either those six first person male narrated novels or the kind of the key classics like The Bell, for example, which are all fabulous. But yeah, for me, Henry and Cato or Sandcastle probably.
I mean, I did see as well, and I remember this being kind of online a while ago. So, A Fairly Honourable Defeat was listed in the novels to win an award for the Lost Booker Prize, the Lost Man Booker Prize. So,
Okay.
kind of there were a selection of novels that were listed, so 20 odd, as being novels that should have won the Man Booker Prize but didn't.
Right.
She didn't make the shortlist of six in the end, but she was
Oh.
in that initial list of 20. So I mean, that kind of thing suggests that there are novels that some people would have wanted to have kind of celebrated a bit more, perhaps. So something like A Fairly Honourable Defeat. But yeah, I agree with you. Things like Henry and Cato is a brilliant novel. And not discussed that much. The Sandcastle, and definitely not a kind of women's magazine novel as it often was kind of characterized when it was first reviewed. And I do think The Philosopher's Pupil, I think, is a
It's such a
brilliant
good
novel
book.
too.
Yeah, there's been such really good attention being paid to that, but perhaps not enough. And as far as the philosophy goes, we talk a lot about sovereignty of good, don't we, and metaphysics guide to morals, which is important. And I think metaphysics needs, more kind of readers. But I would direct people back to Sartre, Romantic Rationalist. I think it's really accessible, actually. A lot of it isn't. It is philosophical, but a lot of it is about literature, and the way in which literature works. So I think if you're on in the if you've read some of Murdoch's novels and you want to think about some of the philosophy or think about where Murdoch's coming from, Romantic Rationalist wouldn't be a bad place to start, actually. I think it's very undervalued.
Yeah, and I think you could kind of say similar things as well about something like the two Platonic dialogues, Acastos.
Yeah.
They're a really interesting way of approaching, of kind of thinking, oh, I want to start to think about Murdoch's philosophy, and it means that you can literally approach it in the form of fiction, So you have kind of philosophical ideas being debated by different characters, and it's quite a fun and interesting. The two dialogues are really fascinating. And might almost be kind of interesting. It might be interesting to read them, kind of to go, Acastos, then read The Fire and the Sun afterwards and see what you find,
Yes, I think going straight into The Fire and the Sun might be for most readers quite might be a little bit off-putting, but yeah, as you say, reading Acastos first might be a really good way in, and you can find them all, I think, in Extensions of Mystics, can't you?
Apart from Sartre Romantic Rationalist, of
Yeah,
course.
Sartre Romantic Rationalist
But
is a
yeah, you.
standalone, but other than that, everything else is in the NM.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think that we don't discuss The Fire and the Sun that much in critical space, in kind of the academic writings about Murdoch. I think we often tend to think of Sovereignty of Good and then Metaphysics as a Guide to Morals, and
Yes, true.
this kind of hole in the middle. So I do think that maybe that has a kind of larger role to play. But then also it's interesting as well because, of course, there was philosophical work going on in that kind of late 70s period. It's just that it all ended up being going into lectures that she
Yes,
gave, and
true.
those were then turned into Metaphysics of the Guide to Morals. So, Acastos, I think maybe I would say, is the kind of different,
Interesting
not a
choice.
novel.
No, well. No, but it's an interesting piece of work nonetheless. So yeah, I'd go for Henry and Cato, I think, having reflected on it. Dan, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back on and giving us your wisdom and your knowledge today. It's been a real pleasure.
No, you're welcome. It's been nice to talk about, to kind of respond, to talk together to respond to these questions. They're all really interesting questions. And yeah, it's kind of been a good kind of jumping off point in kind of my preparation for kind of gathering notes for these in answering these questions. It's been interesting kind of work to kind of refresh your
Yeah.
mind.
So yeah.
Okay, well, how does Murdoch approach some of these things? How might we kind of value her as a writer, that kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, to have them laid out in this manner, and to think about them in this way. So yeah, thank you so much to everybody that sent in a question. And this 50th episode marks the beginning of a new season. So we've got lots more episodes coming up. Focusing on the novels, on philosophy, on some of the new books that are coming out by philosophers and literary critics. We've also got a special on Philippa Foot coming up, as well as one that reflects on the fantastic work of A.S. Byatt. So lots to look forward to for the new season that will take us through into the autumn. But my thanks very much to Daniel Reed.
Thank you.
And to everybody for listening today. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, do leave us a review on whatever site that you access your podcast from. It would be most appreciated. And yeah, thanks to everybody for listening.